with SBS Radio.
You're listening to NITV Radio and you're with me, Bertrand Tungandame, in conversation with the Wiradjuri man, Michael Sean Fletcher, Associate Professor, School of Geography at the University of Melbourne. Professor Fletcher has been selected to deliver the University of Melbourne's NAM Oration for the year 2020. The NAM Oration is a key address that profiles leading Indigenous peoples from across the world in order to enrich our ideas about possible futures. Welcome to NITV Radio, Professor Fletcher.
Thank you for having me, Bertrand. It's a pleasure.
Your speech for the NAM Oration is called Our Country, Our Way: How Indigenous People and Knowledge Can Save Australia's Environmental and Social Unraveling. Can you put this powerful talk into context for us, Professor Fletcher?
Yeah, no problem. Seeing a number of really significant challenges at the moment. In the environmental space, we have the fastest rate of biodiversity loss on Earth. We have catastrophic bushfires that are increasing in size and intensity and frequency through time. We're seeing a whole bunch of other issues like mass fish deaths, mangrove deaths, all of these sorts of things that, you know, are really thrusting upon us the urgency of understanding this landscape we live in and understanding how to operate in it properly. But we also face a number of social issues in the Indigenous space. There's a bunch of social issues that accompany our socioeconomic status and the continuing process of colonization on our people. This manifests in all sorts of ways that I'm sure you're familiar with, and the Closing of the Gap report really illuminated how poorly we're going in just about all of these. But there's also another kind of trauma, if you like, that's going on. And these bushfires, especially 2019-2020 Black Summer fires, inflicted a significant trauma on the Australian people. Not only Indigenous people, but the Australian people as a whole. That's from the direct damage, the fear associated with the threat of loss of life and property and all these sorts of things. The trauma associated with so many animals being killed, a billion animals or whatever it is, 3 million animals being killed. And the trauma that's associated with seeing the mass fish deaths, all of these sorts of things that are going on in this country that we feel relatively helpless about, the trauma that's associated with fighting a futile war against fire, for example. You know, we gear up for fire seasons. There's this angst around fire that really shouldn't be there. And I think that my people, Aboriginal people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, have been operating and successful in this landscape for more than 65,000 years. We have really important knowledge hardwired into our traditions, into our song lines, into our practice of how to appropriately operate on country in this country.
And that's your specialty, actually. I forgot to mention in the introduction that you're a geographer and you don't just observe. Your specialty is looking at landscapes and their evolution in time from the past to inform how to deal with it in the future. From your studies, can you elaborate a little bit more on this concept of how we treat nature and how we're constantly scared of it? But your findings tell us that if we respect nature, then we will survive whatever it throws at us.
One of the biggest issues that faces us that I am constantly sort of trying to challenge and dismiss is the narrative of wilderness, the narrative that country, that Australia, not only Australia, all across the world, really, people have been living in and operating and shaping landscapes for thousands of years. And in Australia, the continuing culture, Aboriginal culture, has been operating, managing, manipulating, creating, changing landscapes through fire, through manipulating waterways, through all sorts of ways, turning soil, all of these sorts of things for more than 3,000 generations. The myth of wilderness, if we look at the Tasmanian Wilderness World Heritage Area, for example, in Tasmania, my research has unequivocally proven that landscape was created by people. If you look at Mardu country in the central deserts, areas that are denoted as wilderness in the latest sort of scientific attempts to define what wilderness means in a paper in Nature, a very esteemed journal in 2018, Mardu country, where they've had a long and uninterrupted management of the landscape, where all of the science behind it tells us where people are managing country, it's more diverse and more healthy and less burnt, you know, less catastrophic fires, all of this sort of stuff that we associate with healthy, biodiverse country falls away once you pull people out. The landscapes of Australia, in particular, require people. And this antiquated notion, this very European notion of separating people from the world around us, or the dualism between nature and culture, is really damaging this country. It's bringing in management paradigms that are based on minimum footprints, minimum ecological footprints, minimum human involvement, all of this sort of stuff. Whereas what we should be doing is understanding that the particular management ideas and practices that we imported from other areas are the inappropriate ones. That the answer isn't pulling people out of country, it's getting the right people on country and doing the right things. And when you do that, you start to see all of these measures that we're interested in, biodiversity measures, fire sizes, fire intensities, all of these things start to get better or in the direction we want them to go by putting people back on country. And many of these problems, tracking biodiversity loss, it began in 1790, straight after the British invasion. Look at bushfires, they date from the 1850s, you know, and they've increased through to the present. You look at a lot of these problems date from the removal of our people from country. And one of the answers into the future is putting people back on country, the right people doing the right kinds of things, and abandoning this notion that the world around us, our landscapes, are better off without people. They're actually better off with people in them. And this sort of underpins the notion of country. You'll hear that sort of talked a lot by Aboriginal people. Country is not just the world around us, it's us. And if you look after country, you're looking after yourself. And one of the biggest underpinning philosophies in caring for country or Aboriginal philosophies around land management is healthy country, healthy people. You know, if you're managing country, you're managing people. And we start to see all these social measures that we associate with when the Closing the Gap report, disengagement with education, poor health, poor physical health, mental health, all of these sort of metrics, they start to improve. That's empirically proven. If Aboriginal people are involved in managing country, all of those metrics improve. So there's a real, we're at a moment now, you know, where there's knowledge, we recognise there's knowledge, there's huge problems, we're staring down the barrel of some really significant environmental catastrophes, and we have all of the knowledge here sitting within Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
The concept of wilderness seems troubling.
It's really, really troubling. Not only in terms of the environmental damage, but it's dehumanising as well. You know, it's not giving people agency. And this began in the Enlightenment period, you know, when Darwin was forming his theory of evolution, the social scientists and other science, pseudoscientists and even real scientists developed ideas of social Darwinism that placed different races along the evolutionary track from humans to apes, rather than acknowledging the fact that we're all Homo sapiens, we're all modern humans. And this has just perpetuated through time to the present day where we can't actually gift, you know, and it shouldn't be gifted, it's there. We can't even gift Aboriginal people the credit of creating a landscape and being so instrumental in this landscape. And you see this play out with the personal and pseudo-academic attacks on people like Bruce Pascoe and Bill Gammage in their rewriting of Aboriginal history, you know, asserting what was written by explorers and historians, or it's not explorers and surveyors at the time, and thrusting that into the limelight. You see there's this knee-jerk reaction, because, and that's what underpins that is a denial of the humanity of Aboriginal people.
The oration is usually delivered in November, and this year, coincidentally, Nidoqueq, which normally takes place much earlier in the year, is actually coinciding with the month of this oration. And the theme's actually the theme of your oration and Nidoqueq, I think I see a correlation. Yours is our country, our way, how Indigenous people and knowledge can save Australia's environmental and social unraveling. And the theme of this year on Nidoqueq is always was, always will be. Is there a connection between the two? Was it coincidental or?
It was rather deliberate. The content is something that drives me, and that's what I work towards in part of my research. You know, like this is the content. But the framing in this way, I think, you know, there's a movement right now. There was a Royal Commission into National Disaster Arrangements where there was a strong Indigenous contribution, you know, some pretty disappointing outcomes. But nevertheless, well, that's representative of a movement now and a recognition in the broader public of the role that Aboriginal people had and still have and will have in the future in managing this country and teaching the broader Australian public about that. And, you know, Victor Stephenson's Fire Country book, all of this stuff where he talks about, you know, we've been in the passenger seat for too long, let us drive the car. We know how to drive the car, you know, like I think this is all it's me sort of capturing and fitting my work into the zeitgeist that hopefully results in systemic and change in this country.
Yeah. And the NAM oration also has the one of the purposes is to profile leading Indigenous people from across the world in order to enrich our ideas. I saw in the introduction that you talk about your own experience living in a country with racism and your own experience. Can you run us through some of these experiences that you went through and how you overcame them? And you mentioned sport, but what other means did you use to be able to navigate this it's a rather rough environment you went through?
I was deeply honoured to give the NAM oration. You know, NAM is the Wurundjeri word for Melbourne. So it's the Melbourne oration, if you like. You know, there have been some real people I really, really respect. You know, locally or in Australia, we had Aunty Marcia Langton and Uncle Stan Grant, you know, deliver amazing NAM orations through the past. And we've had really important people from all over the world, you know, from the Scandinavian Indigenous people, North American Indigenous people, Hawaiian, New Zealand, like really amazing people. So I feel deeply honoured to have been invited to deliver this year's NAM oration. And more to the second part of your question, you know, as a young kid, you're not aware that there's differences in the world. If only we could carry that through, through our adult life. But there is a moment in time where you start to realise that, you know, maybe you're a little bit different, or maybe there are different people out there, there are different types of people. And I remember telling my friends and sort of having this sort of awakening moment, if you like, of realising, okay, I'm different because I'm Aboriginal, I'm Wiradjuri. I remember telling my friends, and then from that day on, you know, from grade three through to, it would have been, you know, late high school, so secondary college into year 10, I was just systematically, you know, subjected to racist abuse and all of this sort of stuff. Kind of a Lord of the Flies experience, if you like, you know, like it was really tough. And the way I dealt with it there was, you know, to be blatantly honest, I was in a lot of scraps, you know, like I was in a lot of fights, and I ended up whittling down the group of people that I hung around with to very few, if you know, if I had a very few close friends, and really just had to build a thick skin, just a thick skin. I'm sure I acted out. I was a bit of a brat of a kid and all of this sort of stuff at school. And then by year 10, I just got too big. You know, I'm a large kind of guy, 6'4" and weigh over 100 kilos, and you know, I got big pretty quick, and that sort of helped in dissuading people from having a go. Yeah, I guess sport was big for me. I was pretty good at suburban footy, only ever really a suburban football player. And I felt that footy, you see this, it's a shame, but it's also good. It's, you know, you see, it's the one place I think where Aboriginal people, their Aboriginality disappears in the face of other people, you know, and you're respected for your ability. And you're in the kind of, and I don't want to be gendered here because it happens with females too, but you're in the brotherhood, or you're in the collective that's trying to achieve something together. And you do that week in, week out, and you're sort of trained together all week, and you're committed to a cause, and it evaporates. It's a really great, it's a sanctuary, really, in my mind, that football experience. And you gain respect through that, you know. And if only the rest of the world operated like that, you gained respect for your actions and your beliefs and the way you conduct yourself rather than your race. You know, I think that's one important lesson I drew from that.
Yeah. Because on the field, on the sports ground, well, if they pass you the ball, if you have to attack or defend, well, they can see your abilities. It's visible. It's right out there. One thing that can be in academia, is it the same? Do you feel the same acceptance in the academia? Or
it's interesting. I do. I think the thing there is that generally when you're publishing, people don't, you actually don't know what the face of the person looks like and all of this sort of stuff, you know. So once you get your foot in the door, there's an anonymity there that kind of prevents that. But there's a double-edged sword there as well. And I know colleagues who won't identify as Aboriginal for two reasons. A, they don't want to be seen as being given an easy ride, and they want to earn their stripes, which I think is, you know, everyone's their own self. I think one thing we must do, though, in public institutions is, as public servants, and that's what we are in universities, is that we need to serve society as best we can. And in able to be able to do that, we need to reflect society. So our composition needs to reflect the broader society. Otherwise, you're just, you know, perpetuating the same problem of white people telling black people what to do in this country. So there needs to be measures. And because of the whole systemic issues with education and access into all of education and universities, we're systematically underrepresented. So there needs to be some positive discrimination and effort if we are to make these institutions able to do their job of serving society, all of society.
Yeah.
And there's another issue with being black in the academy, if you like, is the burden of responsibility falls on you. And in many ways, they can be quite culturally unsafe places to work. What I mean is you are often included into things. And I had a really interesting conversation last night with the Barkindji woman, Zena Compson, and a Kamilaroi man, Brad Modridge, but really, really excellent scientists for the Academy of Sciences for NAIDOC Week. And what I drew out of that is our experiences, you know, that we're there just to tick a box, a black box, you know, they're there. We get everything that Aboriginal related comes through us. We're asked time and time again to speak about matters for country that's not our country. So there's awareness that needs to occur within these very wide institutions that just having an Aboriginal person there doesn't solve all your problems. You know, I mean, there's a huge burden of responsibility because there are so few of us that everything is channeled because we're well-intended and we want to do the right thing. The workload just blows out and it becomes a real burden and people burn out, people, you know, thumb their nose at it, do all this sort of stuff because we're systematically underrepresented. So there's a whole slew of things going on in the academy, but there's a lot of change and there's a lot of goodwill. My colleagues are all really goodwill. And how do we capture that goodwill and turn it into action? I'm sure that's a problem that all Indigenous people and actually all everyone experiences everywhere in similar situations.
And I noticed that you rarely mention your people, your Aboriginality on your papers or even on your website.
So for a long time, I was trying to fly under the radar, I'll be completely blatantly honest. I wanted to do what gives me passion, and that's to do science. You know, for a long time, I was really driven by my thirst to understand the world around us, the way that it works. I don't only work in this human environment space. I work on million-year landscape records, climate, all of these very ecological questions, and they really, really excite me. And I saw what happened to my brothers and sisters in institutions as soon as they put their head above water, so to speak. So, you know, I wanted to really make my mark and prove those things to myself. And then in the last year, I've decided that my career now, in my career, in my position, I want to roll my sleeves up and make a difference. So you know, I've chosen my time. It hasn't been thrust upon me. And I've decided to do it at my time and in my way. And, you know, my blog, I haven't updated that since 2014, probably because I'm just too busy doing all this other stuff. So it's a good point there, Bertrand. I'll update things.
Now, anything we haven't covered you'd like to add? Because there's so much to unpack. And it's a very important period. I wouldn't like to just close the conversation without mentioning maybe the most important thing, which I might have missed in the short period of time that I've had to actually put this interview together.
It's a huge topic, but you know, we've covered most things. I just want people to understand whether it's something that I'm picking up, it's relatively small, but it's still a very present notion that runs through society of the loss of Aboriginal knowledge. Despite the efforts of the British invasion and colonisation, it didn't work. We're still here, you know, and I know many, many knowledge holders across the southeast of Australia who hold significant knowledge in the way that we should operate in this landscape. You know, it's not just with mob up north who were impacted later and in different ways. Knowledge exists all over this country. You know, I've got a guy I really respect in Tasmania, you know, the place where genocide supposedly happened. You know, no, he's sitting there, a wealth of knowledge, sitting there on how to operate in this country appropriately. So I want people to understand that the barrier here to putting the appropriate management on country is not a lack of knowledge. The barrier here is in the institutions. The barrier is in the public who need to change their ideas of what country looks like, change their idea of what management looks like, rid themselves of the really, as I said before, futile notion, particularly because I work in the fire space, this ridiculous notion. It's as ridiculous as the US war on terror and war on drugs, you know, like a war on a non-existent entity. This battle we have with fire, you know, when we have fire brigades, containment lines, paramilitary structures, sergeants, all this sort of stuff running through the organizations, that just reflects an attitude of the belief that we can fight fire and win a war against fire. The answer is no, you can't. And the biggest tool you can use in this country is fire. You've got to bring it into the management in an appropriate way, not just for back burning and not just for prescribed burning and targeted burning. Weave it through meaningfully. And the people who have that knowledge are Aboriginal people who still live on country, who still have affiliations with country all over Australia. So I guess I'd just like to finish on that, Bertrand, because it's relevant now. We're moving into a time where country that hasn't been managed properly is going to be subject to catastrophic fires or big bushfires, you know, and we're going to be constantly reminded of this lesson. So I just want people to think about it, because a lot of people are probably thinking in this space right now.
Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.